When you attend the gospel meeting like we're engaged in here at Knollwood, what do you expect out of the preacher? When you invite a preacher to come in, whether you're a member here or whether you're a visitor from somewhere else, and you think in terms of the gospel meetings you have back there at home, what do you expect? What do you want? How would you feel if a preacher came into your midst and said, "I can't preach for a while. I can't preach until I visit with you a bit. I need to spend a week in your homes. I need to really get to know you. I need to find out sort of what you're thinking. I need to find out what you're doing. I need to really get to know you so that I'll know what kind of lessons need to be proclaimed." Wouldn't you feel a little strange? Wouldn't you feel a little apprehensive that he's going to examine my life before he starts preaching? You're talking about feeling that some sermons are directed straight at you. There might be reason then that they would be. Well, back in the Old Testament, we have a story or an example of this very thing happening. If you have your Bibles with you, I would encourage you to open up to Ezekiel, the third chapter. Ezekiel chapter 3, we will begin the paragraph with verse 15. It says, "Then I came to them of the captivity of Tel Abib that dwelt by the river of Chebar. And I sat where they sat and remained there astonished among them 7 days. And it came at the end of the 7 days that the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, I have made thee a watchman unto the house of Israel. Therefore, hear the word at my mouth and give them warning from me. When I say unto the wicked, Thou shalt surely die, and thou givest him not warning, nor speakest to warn the wicked from his wicked way to save his life, the same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at thine hand. Yet, if thou warn the wicked, and he turn not from his wickedness, nor from his wicked way, he shall die in his sins, but thou hast delivered thy soul." He goes on then in verse 20, "Again, when a righteous man doth turn from his righteousness and commit iniquity, and I lay a stumbling block before him, he shall die. Because thou hast not given him warning, he shall die in his sin, and his righteousness which he hath done shall not be remembered, but his blood will I require at thine hand. Nevertheless, if thou warn the righteous man that the righteous sin not, and he doth not sin, he shall surely live, because he is warned. Also thou hast delivered thy soul." There are two groups of people in consideration in this paragraph. We find in verse 18, he's talking about the wicked. Today, we might just use the term, we're talking about an alien or we're talking about a sinner. Down in verse 20, he's talking about the righteous. Now, twice, Ezekiel was told that he could deliver his soul. Now, make sure you understand what's happening. Here is the Lord giving the preacher some marching orders. The preacher is being told, you go with a message. Here's the man that we know to be wicked. Here is the man that we know to be lost, and if he dies in that condition, there is no hope whatsoever of him going to heaven. If we see that wicked man, we know he is wicked, and we fail to try to teach him. Not only now is he going to be lost, but we're going to be lost because we fail to teach him. Well, he says, well, what about if you try to teach him and he rejects it? He says, no, I'm not going to change. No, I'm not going to live by what you're saying. Well, that man is still going to be lost, but at least you have delivered your soul. Then in verse 21, he talks about this righteous person that decides to leave a righteous living and go back into an unrighteousness. to go back into wickedness. And you see that transformation taking place. You see the evolution of this sinner, and you say, "When I'm trying to plead with you, study with you, pray with you, I want you to repent. I want you to come back to God. I want you to come back to righteousness." So the preacher's being told, you see that righteous man going into the iniquity, going into the wickedness, and if you keep your mouth shut, he's going to die in that condition and lose his soul, but you're going to lose yours too. But there again, you have the opportunity of delivering your soul by at least offering the message. Now let's back up just a little bit in history into the second chapter to make sure that we understand the proper setting for all of this. Back in the second chapter, God is calling Ezekiel to go and to do his teaching, to do his preaching, and the Lord is explaining to him the kind of person that he's going to preach to. In chapter 2 and in verse 3, "And he said unto me, Son of man, I send thee to the children of Israel, to a rebellious nation that hath rebelled against me. They and their fathers have transgressed against me, even unto this very day." Now what if, when I accepted the invitation to come from Kentucky to Ohio for this gospel meeting, the elders had written me and said, "Now Bob, we want you to work up some special sermons, because you're going to have an awful lot of people in the audience that are rebellious." Well, he went on in verse 4. He said, "They are impudent children and stiff-hearted." We don't use that language today. We might say that man or that woman is hard-headed. Now, be sure you get the picture now. The preacher knows the kind of people he's getting ready to go preach to. They are rebellious. They are stubborn. They're hard-hearted. That's why when you drop on down to verse 5, right in the middle of that, they are a rebellious house. Look at the last few words of verse 6. Though they be a rebellious house. The last four words of verse 7. They are most rebellious. Right in the middle of verse 8. They are a rebellious house. Then when you get on over into the third chapter, he says in verse 5, "For thou art not sent to a people of a strange speech and of a hard language, but to the house of Israel." Not to many people of a strange speech and of a hard language, whose words thou canst not understand. Surely, had I sent thee to them, they would have hearkened unto thee. But the house of Israel will not hearken unto thee, for they will not hearken unto me. For all the house of Israel are impudent and hard-hearted. You see, they are hard of heart. They are stiff-necked. They are stubborn. They are rebellious. They're hard-headed. They're set in their ways. Now friends, that is the audience that Ezekiel the preacher, the prophet, is being sent to. How would you react if you were told that you're going to go and to preach to that kind of an audience? We might react like Ezekiel acted. We find in verse 14, "So the Spirit lifted me up and took me away, and I went in bitterness." And he goes on to say he went in the heat of his spirit. Have you ever had something to happen to you that you became so angry? That you became so mad? "Let me at them. I'll just tear them up." You just can't imagine why someone could be that stubborn. They could be that ignorant. They could be that rebellious. Back about a year and a half, 2 years ago, Madeline Murray O'Hare, the big famous atheist that some of you have seen on TV, came to the part of Kentucky where I was living at that time. She lectured on the University of Kentucky campus. She was a very vulgar, a very foul-mouthed woman. I really believe the woman purposely wants to look as ugly as she can. And I'm not exaggerating. I watched the woman. Before she went on stage, rather than making sure that she was as neat as possible, she reached down and formed wrinkles in her dress Rather than brushing her hair to make it look nicer, she would ruffle it up to make it look unkempt. And she ate an onion. She came out on stage being as ugly and repulsive as possible and saying every foul and filthy word that she could possibly say. But she was brave enough to issue a challenge. She said there wasn't anyone in that audience that was bold enough to accept her challenge for a debate. I don't know whether I was bold enough, brave enough, or just stupid enough. But I went to the microphone and I accepted the challenge. To make a long story short, we wound up 2 days later in a 6-hour radio debate on a small station at Nicholasville, Kentucky. You know, I'd listened to the woman before. I'd read after. I'd listened to tapes of her. I'd seen her on TV. And I believe all of a sudden I felt like Ezekiel might have said, "Let me at her. I'm so mad. I'm so angry. I can't see straight. I see red everywhere I look." And I'm glad I had 2 days to pray about it before I went into confrontation with that woman, because I might have said something that I would have regretted. I prayed about it, and I talked to my family about it, and I talked to brethren about it, and I said, "You know, I'm going to have to go into this so sweet that sugar won't be able to melt in my mouth. Because I've listened to her before. I know how she operates. She'll say some terrible things to you and try to get you excited and get you angry and get your temper showing." "Oh, I thought Christians didn't act like that. Look at the way you're doing." So I was determined I was going to be cool with it. But that made me maybe a little bit better understand what Ezekiel might have felt like. He was mad. He loved the Lord, and he couldn't understand why everyone wouldn't love the Lord. And I can just imagine, you tell me they're that stubborn, they're that rebellious, they're that hard-hearted people. Let me at them, Lord. Let me preach to them. Let me straighten those stubborn people out. But notice the conclusion of verse 14. While he was bitter and while he was in the heat of his spirit, it said the hand of the Lord was strong upon him. The Lord had said, "Preacher, I'll tell you when it's time to preach. Right now, if you preach, you're so mad, you're so angry, that right now, if you preached, you might say something that would be very unkind and unproductive to the cause of truth. You've got to cool off for a while, preacher." So the hand of the Lord was strong on Ezekiel, and that brings us back to the first verse that we read in verse 15. It says that I went over there and I sat where they sat. And I remained astonished among them for 7 days before the Lord ever gave me the message to preach. I asked you in the very beginning, what do you expect of a preacher when he comes in? You expect him to start preaching, don't you? But for 7 days, this preacher didn't say a thing. For 7 days, he sat where they sat. For 7 days, the hand of the Lord was on him for a cooling off period. And I believe that the reason behind all of that was so that he might be able to acquaint himself with their needs. It enabled him to spend 1 week now and to try to look at the world through their eyes. Maybe if he could understand how stubborn they were, he might back up and try to find out what made them stubborn, and they didn't know what to preach to. Maybe if he could understand how rebellious they are and how hard-hearted that they are, he could look at it through their eyes and then back up and try to find out what made them that way and know what to preach. So he spent 7 days just looking at the world through their eyes. I sat where they sat and remained there astonished among them for 7 days. Well, friends, I believe that principle is taught throughout the rest of the Bible. I believe that that was practiced even by our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. He came here to live among man, to sit where we sit. To look at the world through our eyes. To empty himself and to take upon himself the form of a man. To be tempted in all points like we are tempted, and yet without sin. And that's why that since He did come and since He sat where we sat, the Hebrew writer says in chapter 4 and verse 15 that we have a merciful high priest who can be touched with the feelings of our infirmities. Jesus knew what it was like to be man. Jesus knew what it was like to be sleepy. He knew what it was like to be hungry. He knew what it was like to be tempted. And therefore we sing a hymn, Does Jesus Care? Oh yes, He cares. I know that He cares. Because He once sat where we sat. Or we might turn our attention to Matthew the 7th chapter and verse 12 and look at what we have commonly paraphrased and called the golden rule. Do unto other people the way you would want them to do to you. That just simply means, why don't you sit where they sit? Why don't you look at it through their eyes? Why don't you try to imagine the way you would feel if they were doing this to you? Now you turn around and you do it to them the way you would want to be treated. You sit where they sit. Now, in what time that we have, let's look at a few different ways in which that this could be used. And how that it might make us a better person. Rather than getting mad and saying, I'll go in there and I'll rip them up. Rather than getting angry at this atheist. Rather than getting upset at this Jew. Rather than ready to tear up this Mormon or this Jehovah's Witness or whatever religion they might be. Say, let me just see if I can sit where they sit for just a moment. Let me see if I can look at it through their eyes. Let me see if I can understand a little bit better and to acquaint myself with their needs so that I'll be better equipped at trying to help them. Let's look at our work as Christians and the way that we might deal with the lost. Have you ever tried to sit where they sit? You know, friends, there are many people that have pursued a sinful course for so long they feel that no one cares. They've been a sinner for so long they feel that there is just absolutely no way that they could change. There's no one out there in the world that cares. There's no one that loves them. There's no one willing to take the time to teach them. Several years ago, there were four of us that agreed to go into South Carolina for the purpose of trying to establish a congregation. Grover Stevens went from Texas. I was living in Indiana at the time. There was another preacher from Alabama, another preacher from Kentucky, and the four of us went to engage in a two-week tent meeting. We set the tent up in the woods, and then during the day, we would go around knocking on doors, trying to set up Bible studies, and inviting people to the gospel meeting. I was with the preacher from Alabama, and we'd take turns introducing ourselves. You know, I'd knock on one door, hi, I'm Bob, and then I'd introduce Frank, and then the next house, he'd knock on. Well, this one particular house we went up, it was my turn to do the talking. So I go up and knock on the door, you know, and here comes this big, robust man, and he swings open the door, and there's the screen door between us, and he sounds like some big bullfrog, you know, and I just stepped back a little bit high. I'm Bob. And I explained, you know, who I was, and this is Frank, and that we've got the tent up here several blocks away from him up in the woods, and we're having the gospel meeting. And he says, you don't know me. I'm mean. Well, I take a couple of steps back and swallow real hard and said, is that right? Well, we're having this gospel meeting at the tent, and even though you're mean, we'd like to have you. Now, remember, I've stepped back a little bit so he can't reach me, you know. But I get brave enough to talk to him a little bit. He said, fella, you don't understand. I'm mean. He opens up his shirt and shows me a few scars. He's been in fights and he's had knifed several times because he was running around with some other man's wife. And he was in jail once because of drugs. And he had been in prison because of some bad checks and because he had been caught stealing things. And boy, I'd take a couple more steps back now if he's all that mean. But you know, a strange thing happened. After we stood there for a moment and talked, he said, "You know, I believe maybe you fellows are serious about this." I said, "Yes, sir, more than anything else." I said, "If you're really as mean as you're saying that you are, there's only one thing that can change you, and that's Jesus Christ." And I said, "He loved you. He didn't come to die for the good people. He came to die for us sinners. And He can take a mean man like you and convert you into a little lamb." And there was something that happened on that porch in South Carolina that day that I'll never forget if I live to be 100. That big mean man had some tears to roll up into his eyes. And he said, "I really believe you fellas are serious." He said, "Everybody in this town's afraid of me." And he started pointing to different houses around him. And he said, "You know, these people claim to be religious people, but never one time have they ever tried to help me overcome all of my problems. There's never been one person to try to get me to change my lifestyle. There's never been one person that's been interested enough in me to try to talk to me about Christ or God or the Bible or my salvation." Now, we were only there for 2 weeks. In the course of the 2 weeks, we baptized his sister. And the last I heard, they were still trying to study with that big mean man. But it makes me wonder how many more people there are out in the world that have been a sinner for so long, they think everybody's scared of them. They've been so mean for so long, they think no one cares. And I'm afraid that too many times, we've allowed our own righteousness almost to become a curse rather than a blessing. That we think that we're so good. That we sometimes think that we're so much above all of these dirty, nasty old sinners out there in the world. And so I'm afraid that what we've done a few times is to build a hedge around the Lord's church. And we sort of want middle-class white Americans. And that we don't want to step outside of our little circle or our little group. We don't want to go over here on the other side of the tracks where some of those mean people live. We don't want to move into this area where they might not be as educated as we are, or where they may have a different color skin than what we have. They might not have as much money as we have. They might not drive as nice of an automobile. They might not live in as nice of a house. Or we wouldn't want to step over to this area because they have things that's a whole lot nicer than we have it. But we know that man is an adulterer. We know that man has been arrested a time or two. We know that family engages in drugs. We know that family's guilty of this sin or that. Well, we know they wouldn't change. Now, how do you know they wouldn't change? Are you calling into question the power of God? Are you calling into question the power of the gospel? Are you calling into question the power of the blood of Jesus? Oh, I'm afraid that too many times what we have done, we have made up their mind for them. Oh, you know they wouldn't change. Well, that one is an adulterer. That one is a thief. That one is a liar. That one is a homosexual. Well, it almost sounds like the list in 1 Corinthians the 6th chapter, doesn't it? Paul said that he could rejoice because he said, "And such were some of you." He didn't say such are some of you, but such were some of you. That's right, friends. The church at Corinth was made up of people that used to engage in those sins. They don't anymore. Not too awful long ago, we had a family visiting with us that we love and admire so much. This particular gal grew up in Louisville, Kentucky. A good girl, a beautiful girl, a fabulous talent with a wonderful voice. She decided to go to New York to study opera. Somehow or another, she got with the wrong crowd. Somehow or another, she started using drugs. She got onto the hard stuff, the strong stuff, the expensive stuff. She couldn't afford it. In order to pay for her heroin, she turned to prostitution. She became pregnant. She had an abortion. She eventually wound up as the madam of one of the largest houses of prostitution in New York State. Strung out on drugs, in her 20s that now looks like she's a 50-year-old woman. But finally, she came to her senses. She knew that she had a mom and dad back in Louisville, Kentucky that loved her, and that for the last 2 years, they didn't even know what state she was living in. They didn't know whether she was alive or whether she was dead. But she knew they cared for her. So she told them that she was going to leave her job. And they told her that you don't walk out on a mafia-owned organization. They would kill her before they would allow her to go back to Louisville. One night she ran away, though. To make a long story short, her parents had to sell their house in Louisville, the only house they'd ever lived in. But the mob knew where they lived. The young girl had to take turns staying with different preachers, moving about every 2 or 3 days, switching locations so that they couldn't find her and couldn't catch up with her. Some of us watched her as she was trying to come off of the drugs, taking turns holding her hands for fear that she was going to yank hands full of her hair out of her head. To hold her to the bed and to listen to her scream and to yell as she was getting the poison out of her system. But I wonder, had you met that girl on the streets of New York? Had you learned that she was a drug junkie, that she had had an abortion, that she was a prostitute, would you have put her on your personal work list? Would you have asked, could you set up a Bible class with her? Would you have invited her to a gospel meeting? But because of the grace of God, today she's married. God has blessed them with 2 lovely children. Her husband is a young preacher of the gospel today, and just a few months ago preached for us at Bowling Green, where I'm now living. That woman now, since she's already set where a lot of other people are now sitting, is probably one of the most effective personal workers the Lord has. When she sees some teenage girl that looks like she's headed off in the wrong direction, she can't wait to get there to study with her and to talk with her and to show her where sin will take her. Now, I'm thankful for the grace of God that has caused us to be able to keep our life above that kind of a lifestyle. But I think that it would be beneficial to us if we would try to sit where they sit, to look at it through their eyes. How many people do you see day after day? How many people do you work with? How many people live in your neighborhood that think, well, no one cares about me. No one cares whether I live or die. No one cares whether that I'm saved or that I'm lost. No one has bothered to invite me to that gospel meeting this week. Oh, I see them every day getting in their car and going. But they haven't bothered to invite me. They don't care about me. Oh, I'm afraid there are many people that feel that way. And I'm convinced that we would be a better servant of the Lord if we, like Ezekiel, could sit where they sit, to try to feel like they feel for just a moment. Or apply it in a different direction. What about that man or woman that had been faithful to the Lord and active in the church for a period of time and then becomes weak and unfaithful? We find in Galatians the 6th chapter that those that are strong are supposed to go to those that are weak, but you go in the same attitude, in the same spirit, with the same love that you would want someone coming to you if you were the one that were becoming weak. Have you done that? If we were to take your membership directory tonight and go down in alphabetical order, can you account for every family? Is everyone active? Is everyone faithful? Those that are unfaithful, what have you been doing to try to encourage them? What have you been doing trying to strengthen them? Trying to provoke them unto love and the good works? What about those even for these first 3 nights of the gospel meeting that have not been present? Some that have allowed other things of the world to take precedence in their life. Some that have pushed the Lord back into second place. Oh yes, Lord, I love you, but now there are too many other things going tonight. I don't have time for this gospel meeting. I mean, we don't want to get too much religion, do we? What about those that need your encouragement? Have you tried to encourage them? Have you tried to look for that right thing to say just to let them know we've missed you? We're concerned. We're praying for you. We care about you. We love you. Is there anything that I can do to help? We need to sit where they sit. Another way that we could apply this would be in the home. Husbands and wives could use this principle of sitting where the other person sits. Parents and children can use that, trying to sit where the other person sits. Have you ever tried to feel that in your family relationships? What about you parents, and what about the attitude that you might have towards your children's problems? Their problems are real to them, and their problems are big to them. You may think it's silly. You may just want to brush it aside and say, "Get out of my hair. That's ridiculous. Don't come to me with a silly problem like that." But have you ever tried to sit where they sit? Have you ever tried to look at the peer pressure that they're under? Oh, yes, to you it might seem small. It might seem insignificant. When that young man, that young boy is wrestling with this certain problem, are you willing to take the time to study? When that young girl has the traumatic experience of seeing a pimple on her face for the first time, you may think that's ridiculous. That's a serious problem to her. Have you ever been willing to sit down and talk with her? I'm afraid that many times we expect our sons and daughters of 10 years of age to act like a man or a woman of 40 years of age. That sometimes we forget that we used to be small and that we used to have our little problems. And that back when we were 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, whatever age through those teen years into college, we wished back then someone would have taken the time to talk with us. Then as parents, why are we not willing to take the time to talk with them? You see, if I don't have the time to sit with my little girl when she's 6 years old and my little boy when he's 10 years old, if I don't have time to sit with them now and to talk to them about their problems, why will I expect them to come to me when they're 16 years old or 18 years old with more major problems? They're going to soon think, if I don't have time for them now, I certainly won't have time for them later on. I need to sit where they sit. I need to try to understand the way they feel right now. Or what about you young people? Have you ever tried to sit where mom and dad sit? There may be some of you teenagers here tonight that you think mom and dad are just a bunch of old fuddy-duddies. They got too many rules. They got too many regulations. I was lecturing in a sociology class in Augusta, Georgia, or North Augusta. And this one young girl said, "Well, now, Bob," said, "my mother wants to know where I'm going. She wants to know who I'm going to be with. She wants to know what I'm going to be doing. She wants to know what time I'm going to be back." I said, "You're kidding me. Your mother in 20th century liberated America is like that?" I guess she thought she was getting some sympathy. Yeah. My mom was just like that. I said, "Well, I tell you what, young gal, you better run home, and as soon as you get off of the bus, you better throw your arms around your mother and give her one big squeeze and one big kiss and tell her thank you." Because I told her, I said, "I can take you back home with me into a program that I'm working in." At that time, I was a volunteer in a 7th and 8th grade program. And I remember one little boy that picked up a brick and threw it through the window of a jewelry store and then stood there on the corner waiting for the policeman to come after him. Later in our counseling sessions, when we asked him why, he said, "Because I knew the policeman would take me home, and I knew they would turn me over to the custody of my dad. And I knew he would take me into my bedroom and he would take his large black belt and he would give me a hard spanking and then he would sit me down on the bed and he would lecture me for 30 minutes. He said it was worth the spanking to have my dad in my bedroom sitting on the bed with me for 30 minutes. There are a lot of young people right here in the Dayton area, the Cincinnati area, the Akron area, the Columbus area. There are a lot of young people whose parents don't know where they're going and they don't care. They don't know who they're going to be with and what time they're going to be back, and they don't care. Young people, have you ever tried to sit where your parents sit? Have you ever tried to look at it through their eyes? Maybe that they're not doing the best job in the world, but have you ever given them the benefit of the doubt that they're doing the very best they know how? Have you ever looked at it through their eyes that it's because of how much that they love you, that they lay down these rules and these regulations, that they're trying to use what knowledge and experience they have, they're trying to bring you up to the very best of their ability? And have you ever tried to look at it through their eyes of the seriousness of the job? That someday they're going to stand there before the Lord and they're going to be judged for how they brought you up. They're going to be judged for the way that they have taught you and the way they've disciplined you. Have you ever tried to look at it through their eyes? Have you ever tried to sit where they sit? Or what about you husbands? Sure, you've had a busy day. You come home, you flop back in that chair, and you holler for the wife to bring you a bowl of ice cream. You ever tried to look at it through her eyes? She's had a rough day. The washing machine broke down. The commode overflowed. The kid got SpaghettiOs in his hair. I mean, she's had a pretty rough day. I mean, every now and then, my wife would need to leave to go assist with her grandma while she was ill or to help her mom or dad. And, you know, I'd be there at the house all by myself. Well, you make up the bed, you run the vacuum, you wash the dishes. A week later, you got to do it all again. I mean, when that green stuff starts collecting all over the plates and the sink, you know, it's time to... Well, see, Dolores never did keep house like that. Little things that men take for granted. She's had a busy day. Our ladies, have you ever tried to look at it through his eyes? I mean, out here all day, people have been hollering at him. He's been fussing and fighting with people all day. He's been cursed a few times. He comes home. He doesn't need somebody else to fuss with. I think that many times husbands and wives need to look at it through each other's eyes. A lot of times the wife says, "Well, how did your day go?" "Oh, it was a terrible day, and you don't want to talk about it." Don't bite her head off. Just sit down on the couch and say, "Honey, it was terrible, and I don't want to discuss it." She really didn't want to hear the whole detail anyway. She just wanted to start a conversation. She just wanted to know that you were still alive. And so the best thing you can do is say, "Honey, sit here beside me." Put your arm around her and squeeze her just a little bit and say, "You know, it's wonderful to come home and know that you love me and I love you, and I can just forget about all the problems I've had today. We're here in our little haven. It's wonderful to love and to be loved." Oh yes, I'm convinced if we would sit where that other person sits. Our relationship as parents and children, as husband and wife, would be much, much better. Our one final point then, what about in the local congregation? Have you ever tried to sit where the other person sits? Maybe as a member, you've not liked some decision that the elders made. Have you ever tried to look at it through their eyes? Have you ever tried to sit where they sit? Do you realize the charge they have? In Hebrews, the 13th chapter, and verse 17, we're taught again, they are going to give an account for the way that they pastor the flock. Have you ever given them the benefit of the doubt? They've made the very best decision they could make. Or maybe you've got a gripe against the preacher. Some of you may be thinking right now, "Bob, if you were sitting where I'm sitting right now, you wouldn't preach so long." Have you ever tried to look at it through the preacher's eye? When's the last time you just said thank you? "Hey, that was great, Wellen. That's right what I needed. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate that." You know, saying amen to a preacher about like saying sick 'em to a dog. Have you ever given that little extra word of encouragement, that little extra thank you? Or what about the preacher's family? When's the last time you said something to the preacher's wife? You know, it gets hard at times. It gets lonely at times. Last week, I had to apologize. I had 6 Bible classes last week. And I didn't much more than just go to get to see her as I was sort of going through the house to change clothes and to leave again. So I had to just take one day at the end of the week and just scratch off a few other commitments I had and just say, "Hey, meet me at the office and let's go out to lunch." Have you ever looked at it through the preacher's wife's eyes? When's the last time you said thank you to her? Well, maybe if the preacher would look at it through the eyes of the members, if the members would look at it through the eyes of the elders, the elders would look at it through the eyes of the preacher and the members, and we're all trying to sit where the other person sits. We're all giving each other the benefit of the doubt. We're all caring and loving and sharing and trying to go to heaven together. Wouldn't we have some wonderful relationships? Wouldn't we have some congregations that were so knitly tied together in a bond of peace and unity and love, a group that the devil couldn't even work overtime to destroy? I'm convinced that in every relationship we face in life, if we'd just stop and sit where the other person sits, we'd be a better person because of that. For those of you in the audience right now that's not a Christian, I wish that I could sit right now where you sit and know what you're thinking. I wish that I knew if there were one particular statement that I could make, one Bible verse I could read, one little phrase that I could quote that could cause you to want to get up out of that seat and respond to this invitation that we're about to sing. I wish I could sit right there where you sit and think like you think right now. I wish I knew what's holding you back, as to why you stay there lost and headed toward an eternity of hell and torment. I wish I knew what it would take to encourage you. Are there some in the audience tonight that claim to be Christians, but they've not put the Lord first? They've allowed their fun and their recreation and their business and everything else to come ahead of the Lord. I wish I knew what it would take to get you on fire for the Lord. I wish I could sit where you sit and think like you think. I wish I knew what could be done to get you to want to do something. Some of you may be ready to do something right now. And it may be that if you will do something right now, you may give someone else enough encouragement, enough of an incentive, that maybe they'll do something. Maybe you'll get something started that we can have a chain reaction from. If you're subject to this invitation of the Lord, we bid you to come right now while together we stand and sing.